We're talking typeface here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The font you choose says more about you than you may think. We're looking at the effects of typography on our emotions, and just a ballpark figure here, there are perhaps 300,000 fonts in our world. A lot to pick from. We surveyed some of our colleagues on the ones they prefer.
Gotham. It just goes well with everything.
Universe. It's a practical face that you can use for many things.
Verdana? It's just always been like my go-to.
Garamond is the most professional font.
You can't trust someone who uses Comic Sans.
Do you have strong feelings about fonts? Which ones do you love and which ones do you loathe and why? Do you have a story about using the wrong font? Join in at 800-642-1234. Sarah Hindman is a graphic designer and author of several books about typeface, including Why Fonts Matter. Sarah, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
We just heard that montage of voices there on fonts, and the question we had posed to the people was, you know, whom would you hire based on what font they used? And there, people had pretty strong opinions. Why is it that we're able to pass judgment when the only information we have about someone is their font?
I think this is so interesting. As human beings, whenever we encounter a new situation, we make really instant snap judgments. And when you're looking at typefaces, at fonts, all what you're doing is you're looking at them in the same way that you would think about what somebody wearing, what's their body language telling you, what does their facial expression communicate to you. So we make all of these really instantaneous judgments, but then we also have these associations we make with different typefaces. For example, Gotham has gathered a lot of associations over the last few years. So we have both of these things that actually give us a huge amount of information.
What are some associations we've made with Gotham?
So Gotham really came to fame, I would say, in around 2008. When Obama was running for president and his campaign was all about change. And the typographic political landscape at the time had a lot of much more traditional typefaces, the serif typefaces with the feet on them that talk about knowledge, history, knowledge and history. Whereas Gotham is a very clean sans serif typeface. It doesn't have those little feet. Although it's actually been designed very much inspired by mid-20th century typefaces. So it still has that notion of history, but it's modern history. But you put that against the other typefaces at the time, and the campaign didn't just say change. The actual shape of the words it used embodied this whole idea of change.
Wow, that's a lot riding on the back of a font there. We're packing in a lot of meaning. I mean, there is a lot of meaning that you see in fonts. It's common knowledge that if you want to be taken seriously, you shouldn't use Comic Sans. So how do these associations come to be?
Firstly, every time you see a typeface, you make lots of assumptions from the context that you see it in. So Comic Sans, there's kind of a hint in its name. It's got the word comic in it. Mm-hmm. It's inspired by comic books. So most of the time you would see it in comic or childlike scenarios. So if you suddenly see it in a different scenario, you might think that it feels a little bit out of place. It's like an actor being miscast in a film. It won't feel true. It won't ring true. And there are really lovely stories. One of my favorites is that when CERN announced the discovery of the Higgs boson particle, mm-hmm. the God particle. So this is one of the biggest scientific discoveries of our lifetimes. They announced it in Comic Sans.
Oh,
and on
my
goodness. Twitter, within minutes, it was Comic Sans that was actually trending on Twitter higher than the discovery of the scientific of the Higgs boson particle.
So one of the most sophisticated science lab in the world, CERN in Switzerland, is using Comic Sans, which is such a contrast to really the integrity of what's going on there.
So that's what was everybody was saying on Twitter. But of course, this is just Twitter, and it doesn't really devalue the discovery for one moment. And when the director was asked, she said, well, we just wanted it to look like handwriting. And the whole idea, a lot of the time people will use Comic Sans because they don't want to feel pressured into actually thinking about designing typefaces. They just want to write something. So in those kind of scenarios, you can understand why it gets used.
Talking with Sarah Hindman, she's a graphic designer, and we're talking about the impact of typography on our lives. You can join in this conversation, 800-642-1234. And graphic designers out there, what are your thoughts on typography? Why does it matter? How does it affect the work you do? Call in. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. Sarah, how does all of this apply to marketing and the way that companies choose to portray their products and what, in the end, what we choose to buy? Do fonts matter that much?
They, in my opinion, they do, because that's what I do for a living. And also, if you just look around any shop, you will see that there is such a huge range of different typographic voices that clearly it must matter, otherwise people wouldn't put money into doing this. One of the first things that you do, especially if you go into a supermarket, is you will filter out the things that you don't want to buy, or you will just look for the things that you do want to buy. And one of the ways you will do that is looking for the appropriate typefaces. If you want cheap bargain, you know that these will be the big, bold, uppercase, blocky typefaces, probably in really bright colors. If you want the more luxurious, the more expensive version of something, you will probably look for more finesse typefaces where there's a bit more space around them. They might be smaller, they might be more spaced out. And these are instant visual codes that cue you into the first level of how you're navigating your way around your life.
Are there trends in fonts? Because we have the sense that sans serif is the font to use right now, and Google changed its logo to sans serif font in 2015. Are there trends setting companies, or are there trend lines in fonts?
Really interesting question. And the answers that people were giving when you queued this up, I noticed most of those were sans serif typefaces. Mm. Yes, there are absolutely trends. I think a lot of the times these come more from cultural attitudes. And so one of the things I do is I look at the way typefaces have changed over the centuries. And once you match these up to what was happening in the wider social historical world, you start to get a real sense of how they map change. So what we've had in the last 10 years or so is, thanks to iPhones, we've had this real love affair with technology and how much it can do, and social media. And also because screens in the early days of all of this weren't very high quality, sans serif typefaces were much easier to read. We're now coming to an end of that trend where people are now wanting things that feel more in tune with nature, that are a bit more local. It feels like there's a little bit of a move away from big business, big corporate, big tech companies, and wanting something that's a little bit more personal. So we're seeing, almost in the same way that we saw the 1950s was when modernism and all these sans serif typefaces were really having their heyday.
Mm-hmm.
And then two decades later in the 70s, everything looked really hand-painted. It was all very natural. And it feels like we're going through quite a similar trend, quite a similar path now. So you have yogurts and different brands having these really nice, voluptuous serif typefaces that feel like they've come from the 1970s.
Talking with Sarah Hindman. She's a graphic designer, author of several books about typeface. Your thoughts as well, 800-642-1234. What is your story about a favorite font? Let's talk about it in a minute here on the Ideas Network. We're looking at the impact that typography has on our lives. It's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. apparently curvy fonts are on trend right now as brands are moving away from tidy sans serif. They're embracing more of a funky 70s vibe. That's it. Groovy, curvy, smooth typefaces have more expressive human feel, and corporate branding people are game for that. Do you have strong feelings about fonts? Which ones do you love? Which ones do you loathe? And why? Designers out there, how do fonts impact your work? We're at 800-642-1234. You can join in. Sarah Heidman stays with us. She is a graphic designer and the author of several books about typeface. Let's go to the phones now with Carol joining us from Chippewa Falls. Hi, Carol.
Good morning.
Go ahead.
Yes, I enjoy using Tahoma because it's just, for me, visually easier to read.
So when you see Tahoma font, or how do you use that font?
I just use it every day.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like it's thicker.
Okay. Yeah, so it has nice differences between thick and thin lines. So what do we know, Sarah, about Tahoma?
It's one of the typefaces that has very much been designed to work well on screen. A lot of the more traditional, the older typefaces were designed for print. So that would make a lot of sense why you would use it almost like your on-screen version of handwriting. And once you get used to it, it's something that you will find easy to read, and it sounds like it's quite a practical choice to make.
How can fonts affect the way we interpret what we're reading, and in particular in books?
Ooh, very interesting. There's been quite a lot of research done that shows that we make really, really instant assumptions. So we will assume that something might be more intelligent. And when we read that book, we read it through that filter. And we will actually, it has been proven that we will find it more intelligent. There have been studies where they've got people to read newspapers in different typefaces. And some typefaces will make, say, the New York Times feel more satirical than other typefaces. So it's just this filter through which we read something.
So do publishers tend to use the same fonts, or are there particular go-to fonts that publishers use for books, or are there variations?
There seem to be variations depending on the publishers. If you're a traditional publisher who has a particular look that you will always want to stick to, so you have a house style,
mm-hmm.
then they will use pretty similar typefaces. Others will pair the typefaces because it will be the voice of the book.
Mm.
And so each book will actually have its own signature language or its own voice.
You did this project a few years back where you asked people to look at a set of fonts and choose which one they'd want to date. What were you hoping to find out there?
I play lots and lots of games that are, everything I do is all about showing people that we don't have to take typography seriously all of the time, and that actually all of us already understand what fonts mean. And rather than me just asking a question like, what do you think of Times New Roman? If I say Times New Roman, Arial, Comic Sans, Snog, Marry, Avoid, and I start asking people, which one would you go on a date with? You suddenly find that even people who go, I know nothing, they suddenly have an answer and can also give you a whole backstory about the personality of that typeface if you give a fun and mischievous scenario.
And then suddenly you find out the backstory of the person themselves and their personality.
It does. The associations we make, absolutely. They reveal a lot about the context in which we've learned all of these things. So I also have another game where I show you a particular spiky black letter on a record, and I ask you what kind of music. And for me, I would say heavy metal, but then I show it to other people and they would say, no, it's hip hop. Or somebody else would say, no, it's Taylor Swift. Or somebody else would say, no, it's Wagner. So a lot of the assumptions we make, yes, you're right, they absolutely reflect a huge amount about us.
And it's so interesting how our eye can pick up subtle changes to fonts. When a company decides to change their logo, they change their font, and we notice we can pick up these subtle variations. Why is that?
Presumably because you know that logo well enough that you will actually see. And also, we're creatures of habit. Once something's familiar, we don't really like change that much. So it takes us a little bit of time to get used to it. When it's a company like Google, their reputation precedes them. Frankly, they could put their logo in Comic Sans and it would be lots and lots of talking, but nobody would stop using Google because of that. Whereas a much more unknown company, your typeface really is the voice. It really is the first impression. So it becomes much more important that you make the right choices at that level.
Sarah, here's a great question from Phil from Soldiers Grove. And he called in to ask how fonts get their names. Some of them seem really weird or silly, he says, like Tahoma. Where do these names come from?
I don't actually know where the name Tahoma came from, but the naming of fonts almost mirrors history. So original, really early ones were just named after the people who had designed them. And then you have this amazing time in the 1800s when display typefaces were going completely mad, and they were named after to fashions. So Egyptian artifacts were really popular at one point. So a style of typeface was called Egyptian, not because it had anything to do with Egypt, but because it was a trendy name and it was a good marketing tool. More recently, we have people like Jonathan Barmbrook who name his typefaces with really unusual names that are meant to make you stop and notice them. So they're almost little campaigns in the actual font naming. Ones like Gotham's a good example because this was designed by Tobias Frere Jones. And he loves mid-20th century typefaces from New York. So Gotham is obviously New York in the Batman movies.
Sure, yeah. So I wanted to know how many fonts there are in the world. And of course, you Google that. And there are hundreds of thousands of fonts. Is that true?
Yes, and as we're speaking, there'll be another one being designed. Oh, and there's another one. It's easier than ever these days, thanks to technology, to design typefaces. Some of them will take like years to develop because they need to have all of the different families. But others, if it's just a quick display typeface, you can create one yourself. So they are constantly new ones appearing.
What makes a font stand the test of time?
Oh, interesting. I think some, like Helvetica, because they are just practical workhorses almost. I'm sure I'm going to get complaints for saying that. but they're versatile enough that they can fit into most situations. Others will come and go. So we will have an era where particular style of serifs are being used. They will fall out of fashion, then they might come back into fashion again. There's also the technology. So at the moment, because we're looking at much smaller screens, typefaces are designed to actually fit within the technology, which is also why new ones are constantly being designed, because every time technology changes, we need more. We need typefaces that work with that technology. We're human beings. We just like to express ourselves.
Do you find as a designer you get in a rut perhaps and keep going back to the same typefaces, or do you force yourself to explore a bit, to branch out?
That's another good question. I would say in my early career I had a palette of certain typefaces I would use. As time has gone on, I now very much work with the client. I work on the project, and I look at what is going to be the right tone of voice for that project. And even if that means using a typeface that I might not personally like so much, if it's right and if it's appropriate, then that's what we would go with.
I used to work with a designer who always was talking about the thicks and the thins of a particular font. You have to get the right thicks and thins. Is the heft of a font, does that have a lot of impact on what you're trying to communicate?
That absolutely does. So one thing would be legibility, and another one is that things like prestige, there are certain concepts that will be conveyed. So the typefaces that would be at the top end, so I do lots of surveys and lots of experiments. The typefaces that are at the top end of the prestige scale are ones that have fine hairline details, or that would have extreme thick and thin contrast. So it looks like a lot of craft has gone into these. Mm-hmm. The ones at the cheaper end of the scale will be the really bold ones, maybe with no contrast, maybe with curved corners, so they look a little bit more like they've been drawn with a chunky felt tip pen.
So as we start to close here, what's up with the 70s vibe that's going on and like all of these curvy and kind of curvy, smooth typefaces? Is there a revival going on to the 70s?
It looks like there is. Flares are coming back in, which I'm not wearing again. but I think if you look also at just what's happening generally, we're loving nature. We're loving air. We're moving away from wanting everything to be too high tech. Mm. And that's very much what was happening in the 70s. And a lot of the 70s typefaces are actually originally Art Nouveau typefaces, which is, again, another time when we were embracing nature and paint.
Yeah.
So I think it's just things are cyclical and this is coming back again.
Sarah, thank you so much for joining us.
Pleasure.
Sarah Heinemann is a graphic designer, author of several books about typeface, including Why Fonts Matter. And we've been talking about the impact of typography on human emotions. Coming up, Uber and Lyft drivers in several major cities plan to strike tomorrow morning. We're asking about working conditions here in the Midwest. We'll talk about it after this news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Issues of racial justice involve all people, white and people of color. And that means considering the systems that have benefited white people for generations and how we should change them. We have two authors, both white, who consider different aspects of reconciling the past. One explores what it's like to acknowledge white supremacists in the family tree, and the other explains how modern Christian teachers are racist. Edward Ball has written 6 books, including topics like families and race. His most recent one is called Life of a Klansman, A Family History in White Supremacy. Robert P. Jones founded and leads the Public Religion Research Institute. He wrote the book White Too Long, The Legacy of White Supremacy in American Christianity. Here's part of their conversation from this year's virtual Wisconsin Book Festival with WPR host Keely Baltina.
Robert, we're 21 pages into your book when you call Christian teaching racist. Some people might think, yep, yeah, absolutely. And there are other people who are going to read your book and maybe get a little bit defensive about that. Why do you use the word racist to describe Christianity?
Yeah, well, you know, the word racist, I mean, and right there in the title of the book is the word white supremacy, right? Another word that I think many people recoil, from. And I think there is a kind of defensive reaction, I think, particularly from white Christians that might say, wait a minute, that's not me. Has nothing to do with me. And when they think of that, they think of, yeah, people in white robes and sheets and burning crosses and then distance themselves from that. But, you know, I think one of the things that I try to kind of write about in the book as honestly as I can is how close to us today assumptions that we think weren't there really were. And this basic assumption that whites were a superior race to non-white people in the world and in the country was an uncontroversial claim through most of the country's history and through most of Christianity's history. And undergirding that claim in the country was Christianity as the dominant religious and moral force in the country and the dominant expression of religion. So the strongest way to legitimize a worldview is to connect it to a divine ordering of the universe. And that's exactly the role that Christianity played through most of American history, was to kind of take what was really an uncontroversial view among most whites, that whites were a superior race, and to wrap that in kind of a Christian theological cloak and connect it really to the way that God created the world.
You say Christian teachings include the idea that white people are by nature different, by nature above people of color. How did people of Christian faith reconcile that? How do people do it now?
Yeah, well, you know, it's remarkable how recently this was just explicit. I mean, I think to our modern ear today, for many people, it sounds very odd to even say that. But, you know, in my home state of Mississippi, so I grew up as a Southern Baptist in Jackson, Mississippi, for the most part. And then my family is 6 generations back from Middle Georgia, in and around Macon, Georgia. But, you know, even as late as 1960, for example, Ross Barnett was running for governor of Mississippi, and he would, on the stump, give a Christian defense of segregation. And he would literally say, as a regular part of his stump speech, God was the original segregationist. All right, that was a line right out of his stump speech. And when he was elected governor, the tallest steeple church in the state, First Baptist Church of Jackson, Mississippi, held a special consecration service for him after he had run on this explicitly racist segregationist platform and put a Christian blessing on him as he went into office. So it wasn't that far back there that it's there today. What I show in the book is that it's not just historical, but even in public opinion data today, you can look at the views of white Christians and they look significantly different. That is, they hold more racist attitudes than whites who are not Christian. It's a real dividing line in the culture today. And so you could still see this legacy creeping its way forward into the present. It's not just way back there.
Let's talk about that, because, Edward, to one of the points you make in your book, it's very clear that this is not something of the past. There are elements of it that we've let go of, but white supremacy and these ideas are very much alive today.
Well, I think they are. I think that white supremacy has been a founding thesis of our national life. I describe it as an underground river that runs through the course of American history. It waters the roots of our institutions. White supremacy feeds the aquifers of our culture, and it remains underground, but occasionally it erupts in geysers of violence, in massacres, in widespread assaults on people of color. And then it returns, the geysers subside, and it returns to the underground of our cultural life. And what I do in this book, Life of a Klansman, is try to tell an origin story for white supremacy, how it inhabits, how it comes to inhabit the minds and mentality and routines of a single family, and how it becomes part of the atmosphere that's breathed in and out by a small group of people who become involved with the Ku Klux Klan. That's the smaller version of the bigger story that Robert is telling.
Your book centers around this direct ancestor of yours who was a member of the Ku Klux Klan. And you write, my predecessor, and you write, our Klansmen. Why do you go so far as to choose those first-person possessives? You take ownership.
Well, yes, I think it's important to try to take ownership of, you know, one's familial inheritance, good and bad. Most people who do family history prefer to take ownership of things in their ancestral past that flatter them. For example, to study the lives of people who were rich or people who were prominent in their communities. But if you think about it, quite a lot of us have ancestors who were involved in criminal activity, and in this case, in Klan activity. I have an ancestor. His name was Constant Lecorne, in Louisiana, in New Orleans, my grandmother's grandfather in New Orleans, who was a participant in the first generation of the Ku Klux during the years after the Civil War. And everybody in our family knows this, has known it for generations. But I wanted to look at it more carefully and try to tell the story of this one man as a way of understanding the mechanisms of white supremacy in a family context.
Edward, early in your book, you have this incredible description of a dinner table. And you describe it, it's cherry wood with a scalloped pedestal. The feet are like claws. And you write this, in a manner of speaking, we ate with our Klansmen 1,000 times. What do you mean?
Well, it has to do with taking ownership, as you characterized it a moment ago. this Klansman was a carpenter. And among his possessions, apparently, was a dinner set that came down to the hands of my mother and was the dinner table at which our family ate 1,000 times. People in one's family life who might have been involved in white supremacist activity are not that far distant.
Robbie, how important is this idea of learning, of knowing not just in general, but really specifically about our own families?
You know, I think it's vitally important. And it's really about telling a truer story, right, about who we are and by virtue of that, how we got to where we are. I mean, I think we look around today and if you ask, you know, gosh, why all the racial tension? Why all the strife around, you know, issues of race and racial justice? Well, there's a fairly simple story for that, but it's one that we don't know very well. I think that particularly for whites and white Christians have kind of suppressed, you know, this history. And I had a very similar, you know, experience kind of looking through my own family's, you know, archival stuff. I have inherited my mother's family Bible from 1815. And, you know, it tells the story of Pleasant Moon. He was a British, you know, immigrant to first to Virginia, then down to Georgia. And if I tell my own family story, just real quick, there'd be one way I could tell it is Pleasant Moon was a foot soldier in the Revolutionary War, right? It's a very patriotic way of telling the story. He came and homesteaded in Georgia on a 200-acre farm, staked out a claim. And, you know, that's the story that I kind of knew. But there's another way to tell this story. That is Pleasant Moon won a land lottery to get 200 free acres of land in Georgia. Where did that land come from? It came from the Cherokee Indians, Native Americans, who had been forcibly cleared off that land by the federal government. And then it was carved into nice, neat little squares of 200 acres to give away to white settlers. And even for him, who was a not wealthy, basically kind of, we would call him like lower working class, a little bit more than subsistence farmer, he owned 4 enslaved people, right? He enslaved 4 people to even make his little subsistence farm work. And when I looked at the wills and the estate settlement, all of his worldly possessions when he died in 1818, 70% of those assets were tied up in 4 enslaved people, right? That's how much invested in enslaving other human beings. And this is the same family tree that has Baptist ministers. And so all of this is like very much compatible with what it meant to be a good, upstanding Christian. There was like, you know, no tension really there.
That is author Robbie Jones talking with fellow author Edward Ball and WPR host Keely Boltina. It is from this year's Wisconsin Book Festival, which happened online. They'll continue this conversation about white supremacy in just a minute. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. Here with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's get back to our conversation about white supremacy in family histories and in Christianity. WPR host Keely Boltina talked with 2 authors about the past and today at the Wisconsin Book Festival that was held online. Here is the second part of their conversation.
You both tell stories, most of them, maybe all of them, rooted in the South. And we really need to talk about the idea that racism, white supremacy, this is not a Southern issue. This is an American issue. This is a human issue. Robbie, how do we begin to think about that? How do you pitch something when your book has deep Southern roots to people here in Wisconsin?
Yeah, you know, I would say that what you said is exactly right. I mean, this is an American problem. You know, and while my book has a kind of memoir, you know, anchor to it, I do kind of broaden the lens a bit. And it's important to note that this too, that like that every Protestant denomination of any size split over the issue of slavery in the Civil War, right? So the Methodist split, the Presbyterian split, the Episcopalian split. It's not just sort of Baptists in the Deep South, but they kind of split into Northern and Southern Southern factions. And it's also to note that there is, you know, plenty of evidence that this is also not just a Protestant issue, that even in Catholic churches in New York, for example, as late as the 1940s, we're requiring African-Americans to sit in the back, only receive Eucharist after white members, you know, had received the Eucharist, had segregated the Catholic schools so that if you were an African-American, you couldn't go to necessarily go to the parish school that was most close to you. You had to go to St. Mark's. That was the Catholic school that you had to go to. So, and I think the bigger evidence for this is, and when I looked at current public opinion data and look at a whole range of attitudes, what we see is that this connection between Christianity and holding racist attitudes isn't only strong among white evangelicals, which are a more Southern expression, but you're in Wisconsin, right? One of the larger expressions there are mainline Protestants, Lutherans, Presbyterians, Episcopalians, United Church of Christ, like those groups. But they score in the book I developed what I call a racism index, and scales were 1 to 10, with 10 holding the most racist attitudes across a range of 15 different questions, 1 holding least. White evangelicals score 8, but white mainline Protestants, that group that's more populous in the Midwest, score 7 out of 10 on that racism index, and white Catholics score 7 as well. So they kind of cluster up there, holding more racist views. And even when I control for region, urban versus rural, those kinds of things, this relationship still holds up. So it's not just driven by Southern culture. It's not just driven by urban or versus rural. Or the connection is between being Christian and holding more racist attitudes, because that relationship isn't there among whites who are not Christian.
What do you, Edward, think about this being more widespread than some of the stories that you tell that happened in the South?
Well, I have a pet theory that the South taught the rest of the country how to behave with respect to race. Most of the African Americans in the United States have an ancestral root in the Deep South. Once African Americans left the Deep South and began to inhabit the northern cities and the West, and the white South had perfected the system of segregation and the psychological life of alienation between whites and blacks. And it was as though we conveyed or educated or tutored the rest of the country how to act with respect to African Americans. It would be a self-deception to say that the great people of Wisconsin or Illinois, Indiana, Minnesota are unaware or colorblind and do not think or make decisions on the basis of race. Quite a lot of us as parents spend a lot of time thinking about where our children are going to go to school. Quite a lot of us as homeowners spend a lot of energy thinking about where we're going to buy a house. And quite a lot of us are working in relationships in our workplace with African Americans, but have no black friends and see no black people in our lives until 9 a.m. on Monday morning. So it's a kind of realism that I would like to encourage, which is a sort of self-assessment among white people about where we are psychologically in relationship to African Americans.
To kind of add maybe just a religious layer on the top of this, there's a similar, I think, way I talk about this in the book is that, you know, so I talk about my, you know, upbringing in the Southern Baptist Convention, this slaveholding convention built specifically to legitimate clergy, in particular, owning slaves. But it's notable that denomination doesn't stay some fringe denomination once it breaks off But by the 1950s, in the middle of the 20th century, it becomes the dominant expression of Christianity, bar none. It's the largest Protestant denomination of any kind by the middle of the 1950s and the 1960s. And so in the same way, I think Edward's talking about it kind of diffusing throughout the culture. I think that Southern Baptists really did that within religion. They diffused this way of being religious and this kind of views of white supremacy that then get spread, right, I think, into other areas. And the other just quick layer I'd add, too, is that when we ask a lot about how do we think about schools, how do we think about where we live, the other question we can ask is how do we think about where churches got built, and for whom? And so, like, if every white church, for example, ask an honest question about why is our church where it is, you're very going to get to some issue of race and racial discrimination, real estate redlining, white flight to the suburbs. Those issues are going to come forward very, very quickly.
Robbie, you tell the story of your great-grandfather who died in a mining accident, and a Black man was blamed for his death. You remind us that the mine was dangerous, and then you write, I can only assume that both he and his family wondered as he left for work each day whether a misstep with his white coworkers or the wrong encounter on the road might be more perilous than the mine. And I mean, I have to say, I'm privileged. I do not feel this way. Black women, Black men, Black families, they talk about this feeling today in this moment that Black people are not safe when they leave their homes. They're not safe even in their own homes. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I do think that's right. And I think part of wrapping our heads around, wanting to have a country where that's not true, right? Wanting to have a country where Black parents and white parents don't have to have different talks with their children. But having that burden of having to think about, you know, a society that's structured to put you at risk in a way that it is not structured to put people who look like me or Edward at risk, right? I mean, I think this is the goal, right? And but we have to realize that if we're ever going to make a headway on deconstructing and building that society, we have to realize that we built it. I think we've got an opportunity here to really deconstruct this in a way that we perhaps have not had in front of us, certainly in my lifetime.
We've only scratched the surface of the ideas and the evidence that you provide in these books. Robbie, I really appreciate your time.
Oh, thank you. It was lovely to be here.
And Edward, thanks for talking with us.
Thank you so much, Kaylee.
And that was Robert P. Jones and Edward Ball talking with WPR host Keely Baltina. They were discussing white supremacy at this year's virtual Wisconsin Book Festival. Robbie wrote the book White Too Long, The Legacy of White Supremacy in American Christianity. And Edward is the author of Life of a Klansman, A Family History in White Supremacy. Stay with us and get ready for some music. We are exploring the year in music with NPR music reviewer Stephen Thompson is here. And let me ask you this. What was your soundtrack for 2020? Don't be shy. Do share with us 800-642-1234, the music you came back to again and again in 2020. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.